curtains like gossamer, wall coverings of pale silk. There were two bathrooms, his and hers, one on either side of the room. Eric's was nearest, fitted with an enormous roll-in shower and a wall-mounted bar to one side of the toilet. I turned on my heel and headed into the second. Dixie's dressing table was a 15-foot slab of marble stretched along one wall. There was a second wall of closets, a glass shower enclosure, a massive tub with jacuzzi, and a separate dressing room with an additional U of hanging space. I closed the bathroom door behind me and started going through her belongings. This impulse to snoop was getting out of control. I just couldn't keep my nose out of other people's business. The more obstacles, the merrier. I found the cologne bottle and a cluster of 10 others on a silver tray. On the bottom of the bottle was the same partially torn label I'd seen at Mickey's. I sniffed at the spray. The scent was unmistakably the same. I left the bathroom and returned to the bedroom where I crossed to the bed. I opened the top drawer in the first of the two matching bed tables. There sat the diaphragm case. I could hardly believe she was screwing him again. Or was it still? No wonder she'd been nervous, prowling my backyard, angling for information about his current state. She must have wondered at his silence, wondered where he'd been the night she retrieved her personal items. Did she know he'd been shot? Hell, she might have done it herself if she'd found out about Taya. Maybe she was only quizzing me to determine what, if anything, I knew. I thought back to my conversation with Taya at the honky-tonk. Now I wondered if she'd seen the diaphragm at all, assuming it was mine while I'd assumed it belonged to her. I closed the drawer and retraced my steps, emerging from the master suite, just as Eric appeared, wheeling himself in my direction. I said, "Oh, hi. Great bathroom. The maid sent me down here because the other was in use."
"I wondered where you went. I thought you left."
"I was just powdering my nose," I said, and then glanced at my watch. "Actually, I do have to go now you mention it. I agreed to meet someone at 8, and it's almost that now."
"You have a date?"
"You don't have to sound so surprised." He smiled.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to pry."
"Could you give Dixie my thanks? I know it's rude not to do it personally, but I thought I'd slip out without making a fuss. Sometimes one person leaves and it starts an exodus."
"Sure thing.
I appreciate the invitation. This was fun."
"We'll have to try it again. What's your schedule like next week?"
"My schedule?"
"I thought we'd have lunch. Just the two of us," he said.
I don't remember offhand. I'll check when I hit the office and call you on Monday."
"I'll be waiting."
Inwardly, I found myself backing away. Ordinarily, I don't imagine men are coming on to me. But his tone was flirtatious, which didn't sit well with me. I became especially chirpy as I made my retreat. Eric seemed amused by my discomfiture. I was letting myself into my apartment some 15 minutes later when I heard the last of a message being left on my machine. Jonah. I dropped my bag on the floor and snatched at the phone, but by then he'd hung up. I pressed the play button and heard the rerun of his brief communication.
"Kinsey, Jonah here. It looks like we found your boy. Give me a call and I'll fill you in on the nitty-gritty details. Not a very nice guy, but you probably know that already. I'm at home."
I looked up his phone number and dialed with impatience, listening to ring after ring. Come on, come on. "Hello?" "Oh, shit, Camilla." I said, "Could I speak to Lieutenant Robb? I'm returning his call." "And who's this?"
"Kinsey Milhone."
Dead silence. Then she said, "He's busy at the moment. Is this something I can help you with?"
"Not really.
He has some information for me. Could I speak to him, please?" "Just a minute," she said, not entirely happy about the situation. I heard a clunk as she placed the handset on the tabletop, then the tapping of her heels as she walked away. After that, I was treated to all the quaint domestic sounds of the Rob Saturday night as they hung around the house. I could hear the television set in a distant room. Closer to the phone, one of his girls, probably Courtney, the older one, played chopsticks on an out-of-tune piano, never quite finishing her portion of the musical duet. I listened to countless repetitions of the first 15 to 20 notes. The other daughter, whose name I forget, would chime in at the wrong spot, which caused the first girl to protest and start over again. The second child kept saying, "Stop it!" which the first girl declined to do. In the meantime, I could hear Camilla's comments to Jonah, who apparently hadn't been told there was a call for him. I could hear the sound of water running, the clattering of plates. I knew she was doing it deliberately, forcing me to eavesdrop on the small, homely drama being played out for my benefit. I whistled into the mouthpiece. I said, "Hello," about 6 times to no avail. I knew if I hung up, all I'd get was a busy signal when I tried calling back. Clump, clump, clump. I heard advancing footsteps on the hardwood floor. I yelled, "Hey!" Clump, clump, clump. The footsteps receded. Another round of chopsticks was played. Shrieks from the girls, chit-chat between husband and wife. Camilla's seductive laughter as she teased Jonah about something. Once more, I cursed myself for never learning how to do the piercing whistle you make when you put 2 fingers between your teeth. I'd pay $600 if someone could teach me that. Think of the taxis you could summon, the waiters you could signal across a crowded room. Clump, clump, clump. Someone approached the phone, and I heard Jonah remark with annoyance, "Hey, who left this off? I'm expecting a call." I yelled, "Jonah!" but not quickly enough to prevent his replacing the handset in the cradle. I redialed the number, but the line was busy. Camilla had probably picked up another phone in haste, just to make certain I couldn't get through. I waited a minute and tried again, still busy. On my 4th attempt, I heard the phone ring, only to have Camilla pick up again. This time, she didn't even bother to say hello. I heard her breathe in my ear. I said, "Camilla, if you don't put Jonah on the phone, I'm going to get in my car and drive over there right this minute." She sang, "Jonah, for you." 4 seconds later, he said, "Hello? Hi, Jonah, it's Kinsey. I just got home and picked up your message. What's going on?" "Listen, you're going to love this. Bobby Deems pulled your biker over last night when she saw he had a taillight out. Kid's name is Carlin Duffy, and it turns out he's driving with an expired Kentucky driver's license and expired registration. Bobby cited him for both and impounded the bike."
"Where in Kentucky?"
"Louisville," she said. "You want him? He'll be in court in 30 days.
"What about before then? Does he have a local address?"
"More or less. He claims he's living in a maintenance shed at the nursery off the 101 at the Peterson exit. Apparently, he works there part-time in exchange for rent, a claim the owner confirms, by the by. Meanwhile, Bobby ran a background check on this cred who's got a criminal history as long as your arm, arrests and convictions going back to 1980.
"For what?"
"Mostly nickel-and-dime stuff. He never killed anyone."
"I'm so relieved," I said.
"Let's see what we got here. Wanton endangerment, criminal recklessness, theft, receiving stolen property, criminal mischief, trying to flee a halfway house where he was serving a 90-day sentence for giving a false name to a police officer. The guy's not too bright, but he's consistent."
"Any outstanding warrants?"
"Nada. For the moment, he's clean."
"Too bad. It'd have been nice to have him picked up so I could talk to him."
"You'll definitely want to do that. Here's the best part. You ready? You want to know who his brother is? You'll never guess."
I give up.
"Benny Quintero."
I could feel myself squint. "You're kidding me."
"It's true."
"How'd you figure that one out?"
"I didn't. Bobby did. Apparently, Benny's name was listed as the owner on the bike registration, so Bobby put Duffy through his paces. She'd forgotten the story, but she remembered Benny's name. Duffy claims they're half-brothers. His mom was originally married to Benny's dad, who died in World War II. 10 years later, she moved to Kentucky, where she married Duffy's dad. He was born the next year, 15-year age gap between the two boys. Carlin was 13 when Benny came out to California and got himself killed."
"Is that why he's here?"
"You'd have to ask him. I'm thinking it's a good bet unless you happen to believe in coincidence."
"I don't."
"Nor do I."
"So where is he now?"
"Well, he can't be far off if he's hoofing it."
"Could have stolen a car."
"Always possible, I guess.
though outside his area of expertise. Anyway, if you decide to go looking for him, take someone along. I don't like the idea of your seeing him alone. You want to go?
Sure, I'd love it. Wait a second.
He put a hand across the mouthpiece. Camilla must have been hovering nearby, listening to every word, because she squelched the idea before he'd even had the chance to ask. He removed his hand from the mouthpiece, addressing me again.
I'm tied up tonight, but how's Monday? Does that work?
Sounds ducky.
You'll call me?
Of course.
I'll see you then, he said.
As soon as he clicked off, I grabbed my handbag and walked out the front door. I wasn't going to wait until Monday. How ridiculous. Duffy could be long gone, and I couldn't take the risk. I stopped for gas on the way out. The nursery was maybe 10 minutes away, but the needle on my gas gauge was now pointing at E, and I wasn't sure how much driving I'd have to do catching up with him. It was 9:20 when I finally pulled into the parking lot of the nursery. The sign out front indicated the place was open until 9 p.m. on weekends. The property must have occupied some 10 to 15 acres, the land sandwiched between the highway on one side and the side street into which I'd turned. The gardening center was immediately in front of me, a low, white, glass and frame building that accommodated numerous bedding, landscape, and houseplants. Seeds, gardening books, bulbs, herbs, pottery, and gifts for that special someone with a talent for growing. To the right, behind the chain-link enclosure, I could see an array of fountains and statuary for sale, ceramic, plastic, and redwood planters, along with big plastic bags of fertilizers, mulches, garden chemicals, and soil amendments. To the left, I could see a series of greenhouses, like opaque glass barracks, and beyond them, row after row of trees, a shaggy forest of shadows stretching back toward the freeway. Now that the sun was fully down, the lingering light had shifted to a charred black, permeated by the smell of sod. The area along the side street was well lighted, but the far reaches of the nursery were shrouded in darkness. I scrounged around in the back seat and found a medium-weight denim jacket that I hoped would offer warmth against the chill night air. I locked the car and went into the gardening center with its harsh fluorescent lights, shining down on banks of seed packs and gaudy indoor blooms. The girl at the counter wore a forest green smock with the name Himes embroidered across the pocket. As I closed the door, she gave the air a surreptitious fanning. She was in her teens with dry blonde hair and heavy pancake makeup over bumpy cheeks and chin. The air smelled of a recently extinguished clove cigarette.
Hi, I'm looking for Carlin. Is he here?
Who?
Carlin Duffy, the guy with the bike who's living in the shed?
Oh, Duffy. He's not here. The cops took his bike and locked it in the impound lot. He said it's going to cost a bundle to get it out.
Bummer. He was really pissed. What a bunch of pigs.
The worst.
You two are friends? She shrugged.
My mom doesn't like him. He's a bum, she says. I don't see why it's his fault if he's new in town.
How long's he been here?
Maybe 5 or 6 months. He came, like, right before Christmas, sometime right around in there. Mr. Himes caught this other guy, Marcel. Do you know him?
Uh-uh.
Marcel stole a bunch of these plants and sold them on the street. Mr. Himes fired his sorry butt as soon as he found out.
And Duffy got his job shortly afterwards?
Well, yeah. Mr. Himes had no idea Marcel was cheating him until Duffy bought a Diefenbachia off him and brought it in, she said. I mean, Duffy's smart. He figured it's a scam right off. He only paid Marcel, I guess, a buck or two, and there's our tag, like for $12.99, pasted on the side.
What about Marcel? I bet he swore up and down he didn't do it, right?
Right. What a dork. He acted all crushed and upset like he's completely innocent. Oh, sure. He said he'd sue, but I don't see how he could.
His word against Duffy's, and who's gonna believe him?
Is Marcel black, perchance? She nodded.
You know how they are, she said, rolling her eyes. For the first time, she assessed me.
How do you know Duffy?
Through his brother, Ben.
Duffy has a brother? Well, that's weird, she said. He told me his family's dead and gone.
His brother's been dead for years.
Oh, too bad.
What time will he be back?
Probably not until 10, way after closing time. Well, shoot, I said. Did he say he'd meet you here?
Nah, I saw him at the Tonk and then lost track of him.
He's probably there tonight, she said helpfully. You want to use the phone? You could have him paged. He's pals with the owner. I think his name is Tim.
Really? I know Tim, I said. Maybe I'll pop over there since it isn't far.
Meantime, if he comes in, tell him I was here. I'd like to speak to him.
About what?
About what? I repeated.
In case he asks, she said.
It's sort of a surprise. I cruised through the parking lot across from the honky-tonk and miraculously found a space about 6 slots down. It was not quite 9, and the Saturday night boozers were just beginning to roll in. The tonk wouldn't start jumping until 10 o'clock when the band arrived. I crossed the street, pausing while a red and white panel truck idled near the garbage bins. No sign of the driver, but the logo on the side read Plastock. I could see that second-floor lights were on in the building. Shifting shadows suggested someone moving around up there. I continued across the street, approaching the bar from the rear. Idly, I tried the back door, but it was locked. I guess it would be hard to insist on a cover charge out front if the wily patrons could go around the back and get in for free. I moved to the front entrance. The bouncer remembered me from the night before, so he waved off my ID and stamped the back of my hand. This was the 3rd night in a row I checked into the place, and I was feeling like a regular. During the period when Mickey and I were married, we were here 4 nights out of 7, which didn't seem that odd at the time. He hung out with other cops, and that's what they did after work in those days. I was with Mickey, so I did what he did as a matter of course. The honky-tonk was family, providing a social context for those of us without any other close ties. Looking back, I realize what an enormous waste of time it was. But maybe that was our way of avoiding each other, bypassing the real work of marriage, which is intimacy. I'm still lousy at being close, having so little practice in the past umpteen years. I found a stool at the bar and ordered a beer. I sat with my back to the mirrored wall of glittering liquor bottles, one elbow on the bar, a foot swinging in time to whatever anonymous music played. I spotted Taya at just about the same time she spotted me. She held my gaze for a moment, her features drawn and tense. Gone was the leather vest that had exposed her long, bare arms. In its place, she wore a white turtleneck and tight jeans. Her belt was silver, the buckle shaped like a lock with a heart-shaped keyhole in the center. Preoccupied, she took an order from a table of 4 and then crossed to the bar where she chatted with Charlie briefly before she moved toward me. Hello, Taya, I said. Close up, I realized she was pissed as hell. Are you mad about something?
You could bet your sweet ass. Why didn't you tell me about Mickey?
You knew he'd been shot, and you never said a word.
How'd you hear?
Scotty's father told us. You talked to me at least 2x. You could have mentioned it.
Taya, I wasn't going to walk in here cold and make that announcement. I didn't even know you were friends until you asked about his jacket. By then, I figured there was something more going on.
She shot an uneasy glance at a table near the pool room door where Scotty was sitting facing 2 men who had their backs to us. He'd apparently been watching us across the room. As if on cue, he excused himself to his companions and got out of his chair, then ambled in our direction with a beer bottle in his hand. I couldn't help but notice the change in his appearance. His mustache was neatly trimmed and he'd shaved his goatee. He was also better dressed, nothing fancy but attractive. Cowboy boots, jeans, and a blue denim work shirt with the sleeves buttoned at the wrist. I thought he'd cut his hair, but as he drew near, I could see he'd simply pulled it back and secured it in a rubber band. Taya murmured,
"Please don't say anything. He'd kill me if he knew."
"What time are you off? Can we meet and talk then?"
"Where?"
What about that 24-hour coffee shop over by the freeway?
2 a.m., but I can't promise.
By then, Scotty'd reached us, and we abandoned the exchange. His smile was pleasant, his tone mild.
"Hi, how are you? I understand you're a friend of my dad's. I'm Scott Shackelford."
He held out his right hand, and we shook.
I saw no indication that he was stoned or drunk.
Nice meeting you, I said.
Tim told me who you were, but I didn't have the chance to introduce myself. He put his left arm around Taya's neck in a companionable half-Nelson, holding the beer bottle just in front of her. The gesture was both casual and possessive.
I see you know Taya. How you doing, babe?
He said. He kissed her affectionately on the cheek. Taya's eyes were on me as she murmured something noncommittal. She was clearly not all that crazy about the chokehold. He turned back to me, his tone now tinged with concern.
We heard about Mickey. That's a hell of a thing. How's he doing?
He's fair. I called down there this afternoon and the nurse said he's the same. Scott shook his head.
I feel bad for the guy. I didn't know him well, but he used to come in here, what, every couple of weeks?
About that, Taya said woodenly.
Anyway, it's been months.
I heard he sold his car, so maybe he couldn't drive up as often, I said. I was trying to think up a graceful excuse to extract myself. I'd only come here to find Duffy, and he was nowhere to be seen. Scotty went on.
By the way, Tim said if you came in, he wants to talk to you.
About what?
Beats me.
Where is he? He looked around the room lazily, his mouth pulling down.
I'm not sure. I saw him a little while ago, probably in his office if he's not out here somewhere.
I'll try to catch him later. Right now,
say, you know what? That's my dad and his friend at the table over there. Why don't you stop by and say hi?
He was pointing toward the two men he'd been sitting with. I looked at my watch. Oh, gee, I wish I had time, but I have to meet someone.
Don't be like that. He'd like to buy you a drink. If anyone asks, Taya or Charlie can tell him where you're at, right, Taya?
I have to get back to work, she said. She eased out from under his arm and returned to the bar where her order was waiting. She took the tray and moved off without looking back at us. Scotty followed her with his eyes.
What's bugging her?
I have no idea. Look, I was just on my way to the ladies' room. I'll join you in a minute, but I really can't stay long.
See you shortly, he said.
Scotty moved off toward the table. In retrospect, I decided he'd probably cleaned up his appearance in deference to his father. Pete Shackelford had always been a stickler about personal tidiness. I cut left toward the ladies' room. As soon as I was out of his line of sight, I headed down the corridor towards the rear exit. I had no intention of having a drink with Shack. He knew way too much about me, and as nearly as I could tell, he was already prepared to rat me out. As I passed the short corridor where Tim's office was located, I stopped in my tracks. There was now a tarp flung across boxes stacked against the wall. Curious, I had a quick peek. 10 sealed cartons with the Plastoc logo stamped on the sides. Clearly, this was a shipment unloaded from the panel truck currently idling outside. I dropped the corner into place. All 4 doors off that corridor were closed, but I could see a thin slit of light coming from under the 3rd door on the left. That door was locked, last I checked, and I couldn't help but wonder if it was locked again. I glanced around casually. I was alone in the hall, and it wouldn't take but 2 seconds to see if it was secure. I eased to the right and placed my hand on the knob, taking care not to rattle it as I turned it in my hand. Ah, unlocked. I wondered what was up there that required such security. I pushed the door back, stuck my head in the opening. The floor area was only large enough to accommodate a set of stairs leading up, and a padlocked door on the left, possibly a closet. I could see a dim light shining from the top of the narrow stairway. I stepped inside and closed the corridor door quietly behind me. I began to climb. It wasn't my intention to be sneaky, but I noticed I was walking on the outer edges of the treads, where there was less likelihood of creaking. At the top of the stairs, there was a landing about 6 feet square, with a ladder affixed to one wall, probably leading to the roof. The only door off the landing was ajar, light flooding out from the space beyond. I pushed the door back. The room was huge, stretching off into the shadows, easily extending the length and breadth of the 4 large rooms below. The floor was linoleum, trampled in places where sooty footprints had permanently altered the color, I could see numerous electrical outlets along the walls and five or six large clean patches. The space was dense with the kind of dry heat that suggests poor insulation. The walls were unfinished plywood. There was a plain wooden table, 2 dozen folding chairs, a big garbage can jammed with scraps. I'd imagine cases of wine and beer stacked along the walls, but there was nothing. What had I pictured? Drugs? Illegal aliens? Child pornography? Prostitution? At the very least, the old jukebox, maybe broken and outdated restaurant equipment, the remains of New Year's Eve and St. Patty's decorations from celebrations long past. This was boring. I cruised the room, taking care to stay on the balls of my shoes. I didn't want anyone downstairs wondering who was clumping around up here. Still, nothing of interest. I left the lights as I found them and crept back down the stairs. Again, I placed my hand carefully around the doorknob and turned it in silence. The hallway appeared empty. I exited the door, using my palm to blunt the click of its closing. "Can I help you?" Tim was standing in the shadows to the left of the door. I shrieked. I flung up my hands and my shoulder bag flew out of my grasp, contents tumbling out as it hit the floor. "Shit!" Tim laughed. "Sorry. I thought you saw me. What were you doing?" He was casually dressed, jeans and a V-neck knit pullover. "Nothing. I opened that door by mistake," I said. I dropped to my knees trying to gather up items that seemed to be strewn everywhere. "Scotty said you wanted to see me. I tried your office, but you weren't in there. This door was unlocked. I tried the knob and it was open, so I just went on up. I figured you might be up there, so I called out a big yoo-hoo." "Really? I didn't hear you." He hunkered, setting my handbag upright. He began to toss the contents back in while I watched in fascination. Fortunately, I wasn't carrying a gun, and he didn't seem to register the presence of my key picks. He was saying, "I don't know how you women do this. Look at all this stuff. What's this?" "Travel toothbrush. I'm a bit of a fanatic." He smiled. "And this?" He held up a plastic case. "Tampons." As he picked up my wallet, it flipped open to my driver's license, which he glanced at idly. The photostat of my PI license was in the opposite window, but if he noticed, he gave no indication. He tossed the wallet into my handbag. Shaq had probably already blown my cover anyway. "Here, let me do that," I said, happy to be in motion lest he see my hands were shaking. Once we'd retrieved everything, I rose to my feet. "Thanks. You want to see what's up there? Here, come on, I'll show you." "No, really, that's fine. I actually peeked at the space a few minutes ago. I was hoping you still had the old jukebox."
"Unfortunately, no. I sold that shortly after we bought the place. Great space up there, isn't it? We're thinking about expanding. We were using it for storage until it occurred to me there was better uses for that much square footage. Now all I have to do is get past fire department regulations, among other things."
"You'd do what, add tables?"
"Second bar and a dance floor. First we have to argue with the city of Colgate and the county planning commission. Anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk to you about. Want to step into my office? We don't have to stand around out here talking in the dark."
"This is fine. I told Scotty I'd stop by his table and have a drink with his dad."
"We heard about Mickey."
"Word travels fast."
"Not as fast as you'd think. Shaq tells us you were a cop once upon a time."
"I told you that myself," Tim went right on.
"Back in the days when you and Mickey were married. We're assuming you're conducting an investigation of your own."
Thank you, Pete fucking Shackleford, I thought. I tried to think how to frame my reply. Meanwhile, Tim was saying,
"We have a pal in L.A. who might be of help."
"Really? And who's that?"
"Musician named Wary Beeson, Mickey's neighbor in Culver City."
Pointer-like, I could feel my ears prick up. "How do you know him?"
"Through his jazz combo. He's played here a couple of times. He's very talented."
"Small world."
"Not really. Mickey told him we booked bands, so Wary got in touch and auditioned. We liked his sound."
"I'm surprised Wary didn't call you and tell you about the shooting."
"Yeah, we were too. We've been trying to reach him, but so far no luck. We thought you'd want to talk to him if you went to L.A.
Maybe I'll do that. Mind if I ask you about a couple of things while I have you?
Sure, no problem.
What's plastock? Tim smiled.
Plastic cutlery, plates, glassware, that kind of thing. We're doing a big buffet for the Memorial Day weekend. We'll comp you to it if you're interested. Anything else?
Did you ever pay Mickey the 10 grand you owed him? His smile lost its luster.
How'd you hear about that?
I came across a reference to it in his papers. According to the note, the payment was due in full on January 15.
That's right. But things were tight right about then, so he gave me an extension. I pay him in July.
If he lives, I said.
Is that what he was doing when he came up here negotiating the agreement? Mickey's a drinker.
I'm puzzled why he'd give you an extension when he's having financial problems of his own. Tim seemed surprised.
Mickey has money problems? That's news to me. Last time I saw him, he didn't act like a guy with worries.
You think the shooting had something to do with business? I'm really not sure. I was curious why he was spending so much time up here. Tim crossed his arms, leaning against the wall.
Don't quote me on this, especially not to Scotty. But if you want my opinion, Mickey was hot to get in Taya's pants.
I see. What about her? Was she interested in him?
Let's put it this way, not if she's smart. Scotty's not the kind of guy you mess with.
I saw him lift his eyes to someone in the passage behind me.
You looking for me?
Charlie needs your approval on an invoice. The guy wants a check before he heads back to L.A.
Be right there.
I glanced back. One of the other waitresses had already turned on her heel and disappeared. Tim patted my arm.
I better take care of this. Whatever you want, it's on the house.
Thanks. I followed 2 steps behind Tim, entering the bar with another quick visual search for Duffy. Still no sign of him. Shaq at Scotty's table caught sight of me and waved. I guess there wasn't going to be a way to get out of this. Shaq must have enjoyed the opportunity to burn me. Scotty turned to see who his dad was waving at, and then he motioned me over. I felt like a mule, stubbornly resisting even while I was being propelled in that direction. Shaq was sitting on the far side of the table, and he rose to his feet, saying,
"Well, would you look who's here? We were just talking about you."
I don't doubt that a bit.
Sit down, grab a seat.
The other fellow at the table rose and sank in his seat, respectively, the physical equivalent of a gent tipping his hat to a lady. I said, "I really can't stay long."
"Sure you can," Shaq said.
He reached over and grabbed a chair from a nearby table, pulling it up next to him. I sat down, resigned. Shaq's gaze rested on his son, his satisfaction and pride giving a lift to his normally heavy features. He was wearing a plaid wool shirt, unbuttoned to accommodate his thick neck. His companion appeared to be in his 50s, his gray hair cut close, his weathered complexion suggesting years of sun. Like Shaq, he was heavyset, bulky through the shoulders, his belly protruding as if he were 6 months pregnant. Shaq hooked a thumb at him and said,
"This is Dell. Kinsey Milhone."
"Hello." Dell nodded and then half rose again and shook my hand across the table.
"Dell Ambergee. Nice to meet you," he said.
We went through that "how are you doing tonight" shit while I squirmed inwardly, trying to think of something bland to say. "Are you here for a visit or are you local?"
"I live up in Lompoc, so it's a little bit of both. I come down here now and then to see what you big city folks are up to." "Not much," Shaq said. "Well, that's not entirely true. This little gal was a cop back when I was in uniform. Now she's a P.I. "What's a P.I.? Dell asked.
"A private investigator," Shaq said.
I thought I was going deaf. He talked on. I watched his mouth move, but the sound was gone. I didn't look at Scott, but I was acutely aware that he was taking in the information with something close to alarm. His expression didn't seem to change, but his face shut down. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see his hands resting on the table, still relaxed, his fingers loose on the beer bottle, which he tilted to his lips. Aside from the casualness of the gesture, his body was completely still. I tuned in to Shaq's commentary, wondering if there were any way to contain the damage he was doing.
Just about the time Magruder left the department. What was that, 71?
Spring of 72, I said. He knew exactly when it was. We locked eyes briefly, and I could tell blowing my cover allowed him to enjoy a moment of revenge. Whatever I was up to, he would leave me fully exposed. Better take control, I thought, get a jump on the little shit. That was when Mickey and I split up. I lost touch with him after that.
Until recently, Shaq amended.
I looked at Shaq without comment. He went blithely on.
I guess those two LAPD detectives drove up here and talked to you. They came around my place yesterday. They seemed to think you might have had a hand in it, but I told them I didn't see how. You showed up at my door Monday. I didn't think you'd call attention to yourself if you'd shot him the week before. You're not that dumb.
Oh, that was a ruse, and you fell for it, I said. I was smiling, but my tone of voice was snide.
What brings you out to Colgate?
Mickey lent Tim $10,000, a no-interest loan with a 5-year balloon. I was curious if the money was repaid when it came due. Scotty began to tap one foot, which caused his knee to jump. He crossed his legs, trying to cover his agitation.
When was that?
Shaq asked, still enough of a cop to pursue the obvious. January 15, just about the time Mickey started coming in, I said. You didn't know about the loan?
You ready for a drink? I'm heading to the bar,
Scotty said. He was on his feet, his eyes pinned on me. Nothing for me, thanks.
What about you, Dad? Dell? I'll go another round. My turn to buy, he said.
He leaned forward, hauling his wallet from his right rear pocket. Scotty waved him off.
I'll take care of it. What's your pleasure, another of the same? Oh, that'd be great. Make that two, Shaq said.
Once Scotty left, Shaq changed the subject, engaging me in chit-chat so banal I thought I'd scream. I endured about 3 minutes of his asinine conversation and then took advantage of Scott's absence to slide out of my seat.
You leaving us? Shaq said.
I have to meet someone. It's been nice seeing you.
Don't rush off, he said.
I made no reply. Dell and I exchanged nods. I shouldered my bag and turned, scanning the crowd as I made my escape. Still no sign of Duffy, which was just as well. I didn't want Tim or Scotty to see me talking to him. The outside air was chilly. It was not even 10 o'clock and the main street of Colgate was streaming with traffic, cars, stereos, thumping. The occupants seemed to number 4 and 5 to a car, windows rolled down, everyone looking for action of some undisclosed kind. I could hear a chorus of honkers, and coming up on my right, I saw a long, pink stretch limo bearing a bride and groom. They were standing on the back seat, their upper torsos extending through the sliding moonroof window. With one hand, the bride clung to her veil, which whipped out behind her like a trail of smoke. With the other hand, she held her bouquet aloft, her arms straight up in a posture that mimicked the Statue of Liberty. The groom appeared to be smaller and bewildered, all of 18 years old, in a lavender tuxedo with a white ruffled shirt, purple bow tie, and cummerbund. His hair was cut close, his ears red-tipped with cold. Numerous cars tagged along behind the limo, all honking, most decorated with paper flowers, streamers, and clattering tin cans. Their destination seemed to be the Mexican restaurant down the block from the Tonk. Other drivers and pedestrians were honking and hooting happily in response to this moving pageant. I found my car and got in, pulling into the line of traffic behind the last of the procession. Of necessity, I drove slowly, forced to a crawl as car after car turned left into the restaurant parking lot, waiting for breaks in the traffic. Glancing over to my right, I spotted Carlin Duffy walking with his head down, his hands in his jacket pockets. I'd only seen the man twice, but his height and his yellow hair were unmistakable. Had he been at the Tonk and I'd missed seeing him? He appeared to be heading toward the nursery, a distance of perhaps a mile and a half. Like a gift, the man turned, extending his right hand, his thumb uppermost. I slowed and pulled over, leaning across the seat to unlock the passenger door.
He already seemed puzzled that anyone, let alone a woman, would give him a ride at that hour. I said, I can take you as far as the 101 at Peterson, will that do?
That'd be good.
Spurs jingling, he slid into the passenger seat and slammed the door. He looked back over his shoulder with a snort of derision.
You see them beaners? What a bunch of pacos.
Groom looks like he's 13, probably knocked her up. He should have kept his pecker in his pocket.
Nice talk, I said.
He looked at me with interest. At close range, his features seemed too pinched for good looks. Narrow set, light eyes, and a long, thin nose. He had one goofy incisor that seemed to stick straight out. The rest of his teeth were a snaggle of overlapping edges, some rimmed with gold. The yellow in his hair was the result of peroxide, the roots already turning dark. He smelled funky, like wood smoke and dirty gym socks. He said,
I seen you before.
Probably at the honky-tonk. I was just there.
Me too. Took a bunch of money off some niggers playing pool.
What's your name?
I'm Kinsey, and you're Carlin Duffy. I've been looking for you.
He flashed a look in my direction, then stared out the windshield, his face shutting down.
Why's that?
You know Mickey Magruder.
He seemed to assess me and then looked out the side window, his tone dropping into a range somewhere between sullen and defensive.
I didn't have nothing to do with that business in L.A.
I know. I thought we'd figure out what happened. Just the two of us. Your friends call you Carlin?
It's Duffy. I'm not a fruit, he said.
He looked at me slyly.
You're a lady cop, ain't you?
I used to be. Now I'm a private eye working for myself.
What do you want with me?
I'd like to hear about Mickey. How'd the two of you connect?
Why should I tell you?
Why shouldn't you?
I don't know nothing.
Maybe you know more than you think. He considered that, and I could almost see him shift gears.
Duffy was the sort who didn't give anything away without getting something in return.
You married?
Divorced. Tell you what,
let's pick us up a six-pack and go back to your place. We can talk all you want.
If you're on parole, an alcohol violation's the last thing you need. Duffy looked at me askance.
Who's on parole? I done my bit and I'm free as a bird.
Oh, then let's go to your place. I have a roommate and I'm not allowed to bring in guests at this hour.
I don't have a place.
Sure you do. You're living in the maintenance shed at Bernie Heim's nursery.
He kicked at the floorboard, running an agitated hand through his hair.
God dang, now how'd you know that?
I tapped my temple. I also know you're Benny Quintero's brother. Want to talk about him?
I had by then passed the entrance to the nursery, heading across the freeway towards the mountains.
Where are you going?
To the liquor store, I said. I pulled into a convenience mart in a former gas station. I took a 20 from my shoulder bag and said, It's my treat. Get anything you want.
He looked at the bill and then took it, getting out of the car with barely suppressed agitation. I watched him through the window as he went into the place and began to cruise down the aisles. There was nothing I could do if he cruised right out the side door and took off on foot. He probably decided there wasn't much point. All I had to do was drive over to the nursery and wait for him there. The clerk at the counter kept a careful eye on Duffy, waiting for him to shoplift or maybe pull a gun, demanding the contents of the cash drawer. Duffy removed 2 six-packs of bottled beer from the glass-fronted cooler at the rear wall, then paused on one aisle long enough to pick up a large bag of chips and a couple of other items. Once at the counter, he paid with my 20 and tucked the change in his pants pocket. When he got back in the car, his mood seemed improved.
You ever try licorice and beer? I got us some good and plenties and a whole bunch of other shit.
I can hardly wait, I said. By the way, what's the accent? Kentucky?
Yes, ma'am.
I bet it's Louisville, right?
How'd you know?
I have an instinct for these things.
I guess so.
Having established my wizardry, I drove back over the freeway, turned right onto the side street, and pulled into the parking lot for the nursery. I parked in front of the gardening center, which was closed at this hour, and bathed in a cold fluorescent glow.
I locked my car, hefted my bag to my shoulder, and followed Carlin Duffy as he made his way down the mulch-covered path. This was like walking into a deep and well-organized woods, wide avenues cutting through crated and evenly spaced trees of every conceivable kind. Most were unrecognizable in the dark, but some of the shapes were distinctive. I could identify palms and willows, junipers, live oaks, and pines. Most of the other trees I didn't know by name, rows of shaggy silhouettes that rustled in the wind. Duffy seemed indifferent to his surroundings. He trudged from one darkened lane to the next, shoulders hunched against the night air, me tagging along about 10 steps behind. He paused when we reached the shed and fumbled in his pocket for his keys. The exterior was board and batten, painted dark green. The roof line was flat with only one window in view. He snapped open the padlock and stepped inside. I waited until he'd turned on a light and then followed him in. The shed was approximately 30 feet by 40, divided into 4 small rooms used to house the 2 forklifts, a mini tractor, and a crane that must have been pulled into service for the planting of young trees. Anything more substantial would have required larger equipment, probably rented for the occasion. The interior walls were uninsulated, the floor dirt and cinder crunching under our feet. One of the rooms had been hung with tarps and army surplus blankets, draped from the ceiling to form a tent-like substructure. Inside, I could see a canvas and wood cot with a rolled-up sleeping bag stashed at one end. We moved into the shelter where illumination was provided by a bare-hanging 60-watt bulb. There was also and a mini refrigerator about the size of a 12-pack beer. Duffy's clothes were hung on a series of nails pounded into the sidewall. Jeans, a bomber jacket, a wool shirt, black leather pants, a black leather vest, and 2 sweatshirts. Being fastidious by nature, I had to ponder the absence of visible clean underwear and a means of bathing and brushing his teeth. This might not be the sort of fellow one would want to have a lengthy chat with in a small, unventilated space. I said, "Cozy."
"It'll do. You can sit on the cotton. I'll take this here."
"Thanks." He placed the brown paper bag on an orange crate and removed the 6-packs. He liberated 2 bottles and put the balance in his mini refrigerator, leaving several on top. He reached in his pocket and took out a bottle opener and flipped the caps from 2 beers. He set his bottle aside long enough to open the bag of chips and a can of bean dip, which he held out to me. I grabbed a handful of chips and put them in my lap, holding onto the can so I could help myself to dip.
"You want a paper plate for that?"
"This is fine," I said. Having cleared the orange crate, he used it as a stool on which he perched. He opened his box of candy-coated licorice and tossed 2 in his mouth, sipping beer through his teeth with a little moan of delight. Before long, his teeth and his tongue were going to be blacker than soot. He leaned over and turned on the small electric space heater. Almost immediately, the coils glowed red and the metal began to tick. The narrow band of superheated air made the rest of the room seem that much colder by contrast. I confess there was something appealing about this room within a room. It reminded me of houses I made as a kid, using blankets and tabletops and chairs turned sideways.
"How'd you find me?" he asked.
"That was easy. You got pulled over and cited for a defective taillight. When they ran your name through the system, there you were in all your glory. You spent a lot of time in jail."
"Well, now, see, that's such bullshit. Okay, so maybe sometimes I do something bad, but it's nothing terrible."
"You never killed anyone."
"That's right. I never robbed nobody, never used a gun, except the once. I never done drugs, I never messed with women, didn't want to mess with me, and I never laid a hand on any kids. Plus, I never done a single day of federal time. It's all city and county, mostly 90-day horse shit. Criminal recklessness? Oh, what the fuck does it mean?"
"I don't know, Duffy, you tell me."
"Accidental discharge of a firearm," he said contemptuously.
The crime was apparently so bogus I was surprised he'd admit to it.
"It's New Year's Eve, this is a couple of years now. I'm in this motel in E-Town having me a fine old time.
I'm horsing around just like everyone else. I pop off around, and the next thing you know, bullet goes through the ceiling and hits this lady in the ass. Why's that my fault?
How could it be? I echoed with equal indignance. Besides, jail's not so bad. Clean, warm. You got your volleyball, indoor toilets, your color television set. Food stinks, but medical care don't cost you a cent. I don't know what to do with myself half the time anyway. This pressure builds up and I blow. Jail's kind of like a timeout till I get my head on straight. I said, how old are you?
27, why?
You're getting kind of old to be sent to your room.
Probably so, I guess.
I intend to straighten up my act now I'm out here. Meantime, it's fun breaking rules. Makes you feel free.
I can relate to that, I said. You ever hold a real job?
He seemed mildly insulted that I'd question his employment history.
I'm a heavy equipment operator. Went to school down in Tennessee and got certified. Scaffolds, cranes, forklifts, dozers, you name it. Graders, backhoes, hydraulic shovels, boom lifts, anything Caterpillar or John Deere ever made.
Ought to see me. I sit up there in the cab and go to town. He spent a moment shifting gears with his mouth, using his beer bottle as a lever while he operated an imaginary loader.
Tell me about your brother.
He set the empty bottle at his feet, leaning forward, elbows on his knees, his face animated.
Oh, Benny's the best. He looked after me better than my dad and mama. We done everything together, except when he went off to war. I was only 6 years old then. I remember when he came home. He'd been in the hospital and then rehab on account of his head. After that, mama said he changed. She said he's moody and temperamental, kind of slow off the mark. Didn't matter to me. 1971, he bought the Triumph. 3-cylinder engine, twin-stock clutch. Wasn't new at the time, but it was hot. Nobody hardly fooled with Harley Davidsons back then. None of them Jap bikes, neither. It was all BSA and Triumph.
He motioned for me to hand him the chips and the can of bean dip.
What brought him to California?
I don't know for sure. I think it had to do with his benefits. Something about the VA fucking with his paperwork.
But why not in Kentucky? They have VA offices.
Duffy cocked his head, crunching on potato chips while he wiped his lips with the back of his hand.
He knew someone out here, he said, could cut through the red tape. Hey, I got us some nuts. Reach me that bag if you would.
I pushed the brown bag in his direction. He pulled out a can of peanuts and pulled the ring. He poured some into his palm and some into mine. I said, someone in the VA?
He never said who it was, or if he did, I don't remember. I was just a kid back then.
How long was Benny here before he died?
Maybe a couple of weeks.
My mama flew out, brought his body back for burial, had his bike shipped home. I still go to see him every chance I get. They got this whole section of Cave Hill just for veterans.
How much was she told about the circumstances of his death?
Some cop punched him out. They scuffled at the honky-tonk and Benny wound up dead.
That must have been hard.
You got that right. That's when I started having problems with the law, he said. I did juvie till I was finally old enough to be tried as an adult.
When did you get out here?
5-6 months back. My dad died September. He had emphysema, smoking 3 packs a day. Even at the end, he'd risk blowing himself up, puffing on butts while he's hooked up to oxygen. Mama died a month later. I guess her heart give out on her while she was out raking leaves. I've been over to the Shelby County Jail on a DUI. Now, that was bullshit for sure. I blew, what, .02 over the limit? BFD is what I say. Anyway, once I finished out my time, I hitched my way home and here's the whole house is mine, plus furniture, motorcycle, and a bunch of other junk. Took me a long time to get the bike fixed up.
Must have felt strange.
Yeah, it did. I wandered around the place doing anything I felt like, though it wasn't any fun. I got lonesome. You spend time in jail, you get used to having other people around.
And then what? Well, Mama always kept Benny's room just like it was. Clothes on the floor, bed messed up the way he left it the day he come out here. I went through the place just cleaning and sorting and throwing stuff out. Partly I was curious, and partly I just needed me a little something to do. I come across Benny's lockbox. What kind of lockbox? Gray metal, about so by so. With his hands, he indicated a box maybe 12 inches by 6. It was under his bed, tucked up in the box springs. You still have it? No, Mr. Magruder took it, so he probably hid it someplace. What was in the box? Oh, let's see, this press pass belonged to a fellow named Duncan Oakes. Also, his dog tags and this black and white snapshot of Benny, and some guy we figured had to be Oakes. Duncan Oakes again. I wondered if Mickey'd put the items in a safe deposit box. Mentally, I made a note. Next time I was down there, I'd have to try again. So far, I hadn't come across a safe deposit key, but maybe another search would yield results. Tell me about your relationship with Mickey. Mr. Magruder's a good dude. I like him. He's a tough old bird. Once he knocked me on my ass so bad, I won't never forget. Popped me right in the jaw. I still got a tooth loose on account of it. He wiggled an incisor to demonstrate his point. Why'd you come out to California? To track him down? Yes, ma'am. How'd you find him? He moved to Culver City 14 years back. He's cagey about his phone number and his home address. Hell, don't I know. I got that from Tim, guy owns a tonk. I tried to bar first because that's where the fight between him and my brother took place. I figured someone might remember him and tell me where he was. What was your intention? To kill his ass. What else? I heard he's the one who punched Benny's lights out. After we talked, I begun to see things his way. Which was what? He figured he was framed, and I agree with him. How so? He had him an alibi. He was boning this married lady and didn't want to pull her into it, so he kept his mouth shut. I talked to this cop, said he saw the whole thing. Mostly insults and pushing. The two never even struck a blow. I guess somebody come along later and beat the crap out of Benny. What killed him was having that metal plate in his head. Blood seeped into his brain and it swelled like a sponge. Do you remember the cop's name? Mr. Shackelford. I seen him at the honky-tonk earlier tonight. What about the snapshot in the box? Two guys out in the boonies. Gotta be Vietnam. Soldiers in the background. Benny's wearing fatigues and his big old army helmet. He's decorated with this peace symbol. You know the one. Looks kinda like a wishbone with a thing sticking out the end. Benny's got this shit-eating grin, and he's flung his arm around the other fella who's bare to the waist. The other fella has a cigarette hanging off his lip. Looks like the dog tags he's wearing are the same as in the box. Oh, what's he look like? You know, young, unshaved, with these big old dark brows and black mustache. Dirty looking like a grunt. Hardly any chest hair. Kinda pussyfied in that regard. Any names or dates on the back of the photograph? No, but it's Benny Clear's day. Had to be 1965, between August 10 when he shipped out and November 17, which is when he got hit. Benny was at Ia Drang with the 2-7 when a sniper got him in the head. He should have been medevaced out, but the choppers couldn't land because all the ground fire. By the time he got out, he said the dead and wounded was piled on each other like sticks of firewood. What was Mickey's theory? Well, he didn't tell me nothing. Said he'd look into it is all I heard. Where's the lockbox now? I'd like to see the contents. Said he had a place. I learned not to mess with him. He's the one in charge. Let's go back to Duncan Oakes. How does he fit in?
Beats me. I figure he's someone in Benny's unit.
That's what Mickey was looking into. I know he placed a call to some high school in Louisville. It was Manuel, I bet. Benny went to Manuel. He played football and everything. Not Manuel, I said. Louisville Male High. He talked to the school librarian about Duncan Oakes. The next day he hopped on a plane and flew east. Did you talk to him later, after he got back? Never had a chance. I called a couple of times. He never picked up his phone, so I finally went down. I was madder than shit. I figured he's shining me on.
You didn't know he'd been shot?
Nuh-uh. Not then. Some guy down there told me. Fella lived next door. I forget his name now. Something weird.
Wary Beeson?
That's him. I busted out his window, which is how we got acquainted. Duffy had the good grace to look sheepish about the window. He still didn't seem to realize I'd been on the premises that night. I found myself staring at the dirt floor, trying to figure out what the hell was going on.
How did the fragments connect?
Tim Littenberg and Scott Shackelford were both in Vietnam, but the timing was off. Benny Quintero was there early in the war, and then only briefly. Tim and Scotty went later in the early 70s. Then there was Eric Hightower, whose second tour was cut short when he stepped on a mine and had his legs blown off. Again, that was long after Benny'd been shipped home. And why was any of it relevant to Mickey's being shot? I knew Mickey well enough to know he was onto something. But what?
You with me or gone?
I looked up to find Duffy staring at me with concern. I set aside my beer, which was getting warm anyway. I think I'll butt out for now. I need time to absorb this. At the moment, I don't have a clue how any of it fits, or if it does, I said. I may talk to you later when I've had a chance to think. You'll be around?
Here.
Or to talk. You want me to walk you out? I said, please. It's dark as pitch out there. I let myself into my apartment at 11:15, surprised to realize my entire conversation with Duffy had only taken an hour. I set up a pot of coffee and flipped the switch, letting it brew while I stretched some of the kinks out of my neck. I felt a faint headache perched between my eyes like a frown. I was longing for bed, but there was work to do yet. While the information was fresh, I opened my desk drawer and pulled out a fresh pack of lined index cards. Then I retrieved from their hiding place the various items I'd snitched from Mickey's. I sat in my swivel chair, jotting down everything I could remember from the evening. Activities at the honky-tonk were turning out to be less sinister than I'd imagined. Maybe, as Tim had said, Mickey simply went there to drink and hustle Taya. I had to admit philandering would have been in character for him. When the coffee was done, I got up from my chair and poured myself a mug, adding milk that seemed only mildly sour. I returned to my desk where I remained on my feet, idly pushing at the index cards. There were still countless minor matters that didn't fit the frame. Mickey's being shot with my gun, the long, hissing message on my answering machine. That had originated from his apartment the afternoon of March 27th. Who'd called me and why? If Mickey... Why not leave a message? Why let the tape simply run to the end? If it wasn't Mickey, then what was the purpose? To imply contact between us? That had certainly made me look bad in the eyes of the police. I sat down at my desk and began to play with the cards. I was left with the assumption Mickey was on the track of Benny Quintero's killer. That question would nag at him as long as he lived. Benny's death had never been officially ruled a homicide, but Mickey knew he'd been blamed, despite the fact that charges had never been filed. In light of his checkered history with the department, his involvement in the matter had called his credibility into question and further damaged his already tainted reputation. As he saw it, his only choice was to abandon the profession he'd loved. His life after that had never amounted to much. Booze, women, a shabby apartment. He couldn't even hold on to the sorry job he'd found. Pacific Coast Security with its faux cop uniform and its dime store badge. He must have dreamed of escape, creating a way out with his caches of money and his phony IDs. I turned over a few cards, making a column, sorting facts in no particular order. Idly, I set two index cards on edge, using the weight of each to support the other. I added a third, leaving the right side of my brain in neutral while I constructed a maze. Building card houses was another way I'd amused myself as a kid. The first floor was easy, requiring patience and dexterity, but not much else.
To add a second story to the first, you had to append a flat layer of cards, deftly floating a ceiling on the substructure until the whole of it was covered. Then began the real work, starting again from square one. First, balance two cards atop the structure below, using the pair for their mutual support. Then add a third at an angle to the first two. Then add a fourth, then a fifth. At any point in the process, as the overall dimensions increased, there was always the danger that the whole of it would collapse, tumbling in on itself like, well, a house of cards. Sometimes, perversely, I'd even done this myself, snapping a corner with my finger, watching as the cards deconstructed in slow motion like a demolition project. I glanced at the card in my hand, reading the note on it before I added it to the pile. Carefully, I added another card to the maze. I paused to remove it, reading the datum again. I experienced a jolt of insight and I felt myself blink. I'd seen a connection. Two index cards suddenly appearing in conjunction. What a dummy I was that I hadn't seen it before. A name showed up twice, and I could feel my perception shift. It was like the sharp dislocation of a tumbler coming out of nowhere, fading away soon after. What I spotted was the name Del Ambergie, the man to whom Shaq had introduced me at the Tonk that night. Delbert Ambergie was also the name on one of Mickey's packets of fake IDs. California driver's license, credit cards, social security card. I set the index cards aside, pulling out the documents with Mickey's face laminated on top of what were probably Delbert's vital statistics. I swiveled in my swivel chair and studied the effect. Did these documents belong to Delbert, or had his identity been lifted? Was the date of birth real or bogus, borrowed or invented, and how had it been done? I knew credit card scammers often got into dumpster diving, coming up with charge slips or carbons, even credit card statements discarded once the monthly bills had been paid. The information on the statements could be used to generate additional credit. The scammer would apply for cards based on lines of credit previously established by the individual in question. Any number of new accounts might be opened in this way. With a name, address, and social security number, ATM cards could be obtained along with blank checks or proceeds from insurance policies. The scammer would supply the credit company with a substitute address, so the owner of the card remained unaware that goods and services were being charged to his, her legitimate account. The cards could also be milked through a series of cash withdrawals. Once the credit limit was exceeded, the scammer could either make the minimum payment or move on, fencing items or selling them at a discount, pocketing the profits. Actually, the counterfeit documents, like those in Mickey's possession, were worth money on the open market, where felons, illegal aliens, and the chronically bankrupt could buy a brand new start in life with thousands of dollars of fresh credit at their disposal. I went back to Mickey's financial statements. I studied his savings passbook, beginning to understand the regular withdrawals of $600 on dates that corresponded with his trips to the Tonk. I thought about Tim and the conversation we'd had about the second floor, where he was claiming he might add tables. In retrospect, I marveled at how carefully I'd been duped. He'd offered me the bait, the unlocked door, and the subsequent glimpse of what had appeared to be undeveloped floor space. I'd seen the bouncer scan the driver's licenses of those granted admission to the bar. Since the bar retained a copy of each transaction, the credit card numbers would have been easy enough to match to the driver's license data. I couldn't guess at the whole of it, but there were people who'd know. I looked at my watch again. It was 1:55. I said, oh shit. I had told Taya I'd meet her as soon as she got off work at 2. I leapt up, shoved all the cards in my desk drawer and locked it, put Mickey's phony IDs in their hiding place. I grabbed my jacket and car keys. Within minutes, I was on 101, driving north again toward Colgate, restraining the temptation to put the gas pedal to the floor. Traffic was light, the freeway virtually deserted, but I knew this was the hour when the CHP would be out. I didn't need a traffic stop or a speeding ticket. I found myself talking out loud, encouraging the VW's performance, praying Taya would wait for me at the coffee shop until I got there. The 24-hour coffee shop shared a parking lot with the bowling alley next door. Every slot was filled, and I groaned as I circled looking for a place. Finally, I left my car in a moderately legal spot. I cut the lights and the engine as I opened the car door and emerged. It was 2:13. I locked the car and then did a run walk to the restaurant, pausing for breath as I hauled the door open and started looking for her. Taya sat at a back booth, smoking a cigarette. The harsh, fluorescent lighting washed all the lines from her face, leaving her expression as blank as kabuki makeup. I slid into the seat across the table from her. "Thanks for waiting," I said. "I was caught up in paperwork and lost track of the time." "Doesn't matter," she said.